Good evening. The date is April 6th, 1971, and tonight we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of the birth of the prominent American composer, Andrew Imrie, who lives and teaches in Berkeley, California. We're going to open this program with a very short work to get you started on Mr. Imrie's music. It's a piece he wrote in 1967. It's called Dandelion Wine, and is scored for oboe, violin, viola, actually two violins, clarinet, cello, piano. This performance was given at the University of California on November 16th, 1970. After this performance, we'll return with our guest, Robert Commande of the San Francisco Chronicle, and the composer, Andrew Imrie, for a discussion of this man's music. Here is Dandelion Wine, composed in 1967 by Andrew Imrie. Our program of music by Andrew Imbrie has opened with a performance of Dandelion Wine, composed in 1967. Our performers in that recording were conducted by Fred Lairdahl. You heard Robin May, Jonathan Cooner, Pamela Siskin, Alan Pollock, Nels Bruseth, Anita Herron, and Walter Winslow performing. Welcome, Mr. Imbrie and Mr. Commande. Glad you could make it.
Thank you.
What shall we begin with?
Well, I think Dandelion Wine, which we have just heard, provides an interesting look into some of Andrew Imbrie's personality, and much of his personality that isn't obvious to someone coming into a concert hall and hearing a very involved and complex and also very expressive style. The impression of a composer is one of great earnestness, and I have always found a tremendous amount of whimsy and fantasy in his work, and I think Dandelion Wine has a great deal of that. And maybe something about where you got the idea and why the title.
Well, the title is probably familiar to many people as the title of a novel by Ray Bradbury, in which he describes the his own boyhood experiences as seen through the eyes of an adult. And he symbolizes the collapsing of time, just as Proust symbolizes it in so many ways. But the way that Bradbury chooses is the device of the bottling of dandelion wine, the idea being that you crush the dandelions in the summertime, you bottle them, and you put the date on in which you bottle it. You put the date on the bottle, and then in the wintertime you open it and drink the wine, and this has the magical effect of wiping out the intervening period. And so the thought of something recollected in tranquility is behind the formal structure of this work, in which I use recapitulatory devices, but mostly with the idea of making it seem as if much has happened, and yet really the time span has been very short. The piece is only something like 5 minutes long, but I'd like to leave the listener with the impression of having lived a lifetime between the beginning and the ending of the piece.
The whole idea of recollected images goes through your music and across many changes of style that you have gone through. I recall in one of your quartets, I think it's the second quartet, there are suggestions and ideas of Japanese origin that crop up in the work, or that gave you ideas that appeared in the work, and a lot of people listening close will hear a significant influence of jazz from time, a very jazzy rhythms. In the opera you wrote what was originally titled Three Against Christmas, and now it's called Christmas in Peeblestown. You used suggestions of old carols or old carol ideas to evoke associations with Christmas. And there are many, many other examples. Is this does this happen in most of your works?
I think that's an element. I think that one is living nowadays in a time when the relation between present and past is a very strained one. There are those, as you know, who try to wipe out the past entirely and say that music began in 1950 or 1960 or yesterday or whenever. And in so doing, I think they're doing violence to a very important element in art, that is the relation between the present and the past. However, I don't think it's possible nowadays to adopt a completely traditional attitude, simply to write as if nothing had happened since 1960 or 1950. One has to take into account everything that's going on, but things are changing so fast that naturally the element of nostalgia in our experience is a very real one, and I think it's one that is not recognized by many artists who adopt the here and now position. And I think that the element of nostalgia is something which can be artistically dealt with and, if you like, exercised or perhaps sublimated in art. That in order to do this, you have to come to terms with the threat of what you might call eclecticism, which I am against. I don't like eclectic music. And so you're in any situation where I attempt to evoke, I run the risk of eclecticism, and I think that the attempt to solve the problem of eclecticism is one of the many things which leads me to find artistic solutions. And it excites me, and it stimulates me to creativity.
At this point, I think our listeners would be interested in your background, because it's long and it has a lot of interesting you studied with some interesting people, and maybe you should talk about that for a moment.
Well, I studied piano starting at the age of four with a very fine lady who lives in New York now, whose name is Anne Abadjian Norahad. She was a pupil of Leo Ornstein. Eventually, after I had studied with Anne Norahad several years, her name was then Anne Abadjian, I studied with Mrs. Ornstein and then with Mr. Ornstein for most of my adolescent years.
Could you identify him to our listeners?
Well, I'm sure some of you will remember the name, but probably not the music. He was a composer, he is a composer, and a pianist, who came to this country right after the Russian Revolution and became identified at one time with the avant-garde of the period, particularly with people like Henry Cowell and others who were writing what at that time was considered to be experimental, far-out music. At the same time, he maintained himself as a pianist and achieved a considerable reputation as an ordinary concert pianist, and went into piano teaching, gave up composing somewhere along the line, or at least did not write experimental music again for after maybe the 20s or something like that. And my experience with him was after this time, I started studying with him probably around 1930, and to me he was just a piano teacher, but one who encouraged me in composition. He didn't give me much specific criticism, but he did encourage me, and the kind of criticism he did give me was mostly in the line of what sounded old-fashioned or what sounded sort of corny and what I should avoid. But he didn't have the technique for really making me understand what the problems of composition were. It wasn't until I studied with Roger Sessions, perhaps I should mention, although I don't always mention this, that I did spend a short time studying with Nadia Boulanger one summer. But since this is kind of like presenting your union card to the neoclassic club, I usually don't mention it because I don't find myself in sympathy with her ideals or with those of many of her pupils, although I think in many ways she's a fine musician. But my main influence has been from Roger Sessions, whom I started studying with immediately after the summer with Boulanger. I started with Sessions in 1937 and continued studying with him through my undergraduate years at Princeton, and then I followed him to California and studied with him, got my master's degree at Berkeley, and in fact, he's the reason that I'm here, I suppose. He went back to Princeton, but I stayed on.
But many of your generation did compose in the neoclassic school. How did you avoid that, or what was in you to make you change your
Well, I found, I don't know how I avoided it, except it was a matter of I suppose, my innate taste, my innate sensibility, which didn't respond to this particular thing. I respect Stravinsky's music of that period very much more now than I did at the time it was being written, and I think this is often the case. The things that you fight against most strongly at one period in your life, you tend to reevaluate later on. But I never could, nor never would even now, be able to write that kind of music. And I think that neoclassicism as a movement has ceased at this point. I don't think it's an issue anymore, but it was very much an issue at the time I was studying. And I can only say that at that time, as I found it sterile. I found that it did not give me what I wanted out of music, and what I wanted out of music was really to be able to say something. And I wasn't interested in all the kind of posings that the neoclassicists were involved with the sort of the attitude towards not being expressive and being serene in a sort of a very self-conscious way, and all of this turned me off. That's all I can say.
This reflects on our opening remarks, mm-hmm. or in your remarks about the importance of nostalgia or the effect of nostalgia in connection with the past. And you imply, and it would seem so to me, that the neoclassicist's attitude towards the past was a very different kind of. One even can't call it nostalgia. One can call it perhaps characterizing of the past, which is different in kind from the approach you have in dealing with the music and the traditions that you have assimilated.
Well, you see, what they didn't want, what they were trying to wipe out, was the immediate past. And in so doing, they espoused the distant past as a substitute. And I don't think this is natural.
That isn't entirely.
But they were the anti-Wagnerians. They were the anti-romanticists. The people, the things they were trying to wipe the slate clean of was romanticism. And I have the same reaction against people who try to wipe the immediate past out as I do against people nowadays who say Schoenberg is dead, the symphony is dead, the string quartet is dead.
Well, except that that Stravinsky, for example, in returning to Mussorgsky and Tchaikovsky, was certainly respectful of the immediate past, but I think perhaps what in his later what are the high neoclassic works was trying to draw out the expressiveness, the overexpressiveness, the sentimentality which he avoided, and that's of course. Such a crux of that era that I suppose you could call it wiping out the past.
Well, I think that it's true that it was necessary to redress the balance. It was necessary to correct certain excesses. And what struck me as quite strange recently, since I am teaching a course in contemporary chamber music right now at the university, I did a little rereading of some of the writings of both Schoenberg and Stravinsky of that period. And what struck me was the similarity rather than the difference in their viewpoints about so many things, about their own compositional processes. It was just that there was a slight difference of emphasis. Schoenberg never rejected his immediate past, but at the same time his very, very strong interest in formal logic was the analog of Stravinsky's very, very strong interest in another kind of logic. But Stravinsky seemed to feel that it was necessary to pick only those things from the immediate past which fitted into a sort of neoclassic conception. In other words, it wasn't the symphonies of Tchaikovsky that he admired, it was the ballets, you see.
Yes.
Are we going to talk about some of your early style and then go on and hear some of the later compositions?
Well, the very early style, I don't think we have examples of, because Andrew Imbrie, as he suggested, but he didn't go all the way with it, really started out as a pianist and for a long time was, as I know it, had in mind a pianist career and even studied for a while with Casa de Sue in Fontainebleau. And
that was not in Fontainebleau.
Wasn't actually. It? But in any case, he had a real concert career in front of him before he... moved into composition and stayed there.
The kind of music that
he was writing in that style in that period was had a very strong French influence in his very youngest.
I was fascinated with Debussy and Ravel at that period.
As who wasn't?
Yes, as who wasn't. Right. But again, I think that what that meant was simply that I think almost every composer starts in an incomplete sort of way, in an unformed sort of way, and what happens typically is that composers in their early stages very often are either intuitively very good harmonists or they're intuitively very good contrapuntalists, and then they have to learn the other skill. And I started off because I was a pianist. I started off as being very much turned on by harmony, by rich harmony particularly. And so the Debussy and Ravel and Rimsky-Korsakov and all that bag, all those things really made me respond by trying to imitate. And it was only later that I began to understand the importance of line and the importance of the horizontal aspect of music. And since I acquired this, now I've perhaps moved almost in the other direction, so that now I'm perhaps more a contrapuntist than I am a harmonist at this point.
Now, in this, I know we're going to hear an early work of yours very shortly, something from the first quartet. Looking back on that work, how would you view it in terms of what there is in this work that you still identify with as ongoing in your musical language, and what aspects of it do you feel represent this earlier, more harmonic or sonority conscious view?
Well, I don't know that I want to pin it down to the harmony versus counterpoint issue
right,
so much.
Right. You brought that up.
I brought it up, but by the time I'd written the first quartet, I had already made my first stab at solving this problem in my own style. I might say, by way of preface, that the first quartet is my first real piece. Everything up to that time that I had written, I was quite aware of as being student work. Everything I wrote before the first quartet was unsatisfactory to me at the time I wrote it, and I was very much upset by the fact that I couldn't seem to get what I wanted, that whatever I wrote seemed to sound stale, corny, and derived to me. I didn't need any teacher to tell me this. And I think that one thing that did me a great deal of good at that time was a special project that I undertook at Princeton in my junior year. And at that time, we had a two-week period in which there were no classes. And we pursued projects, whatever they might be. And my project was to write a piece every day for 2 weeks. It didn't matter how bad the piece was or how or what kind of style it was in, but the idea was I was to complete it, no matter how short it was. It had to be a complete piece. And this was a traumatic experience for me because I hated everything I wrote during that two-week period. But it must have acted as some kind of catharsis because the next thing I did after that was to write the first quartet. And it came out, and it sort of astonished me at the time that it came out, because it came out sounding the way I wanted it to sound, and it didn't seem stale, corny, or derived. It seemed to me as if, at last, I was writing my own music, and this is the first piece of which I could say this. Now, naturally, it has derivations. For example, there was one period, many years later, when I heard a live performance of the Bartók Second Quartet. And I suddenly realized that I had swiped considerable passages from the Bartók Second Quartet without knowing it, because I had listened. Those were the first and second quartets of Bartók at that time were the only Bartók quartets available on records or even in published form at that time in this country. And I'd listened to those records with great attention and interest. And then I had returned the records to the record library and had sort of forgotten about them. And when I came to write my own piece, I wasn't aware that I was borrowing this music. Until many years later, I heard the Bartók again, and all of a sudden I knew perfectly well that I had subconsciously borrowed it. It wasn't just that it sounded that way, just that I knew I could all of a sudden realize what it was that I had done. But this doesn't prevent me from saying, nevertheless, that I think this is my first real piece, and that one of the things that I remember about the second movement, which we will play in a moment, is that it all came out of one progression in which the four instruments converge upon one another in contrary motion towards a certain chord, which is like a mixture of a major and minor chord. I was quite tickled by this progression, and I went around playing it to all my friends and saying, look, I just discovered a progression, and I'm going to write a piece about it. And my friends said, so what? You know, I'd play it for them. It wouldn't do anything to them at all. And this is how I learned that an idea is what you do with it. I've been told this before. But this is the way it was dramatically brought home to me. So I had to go and write the piece to prove that this was, in fact, a good, interesting progression, at least as I saw it. And so the second movement of this quartet grew out of what I felt about what could be done with that idea.
We hear now the Juilliard String Quartet performing the second movement of the quartet in B-flat major, completed in June 1942 by our guest tonight, Andrew Imbrie.
Thank you.
That was the second movement of the Quartet in B-flat Major, 1942, by Andrew Imbrie, and you heard the Juilliard String Quartet on a record which is still available on Columbia on their Collector's Series, and the number is CML4844. We pause now for station identification.
These are the Pacifica stations, KPFA and KPFB, in Berkeley.
It was shortly after this quartet that Robert Commande met Andrew Imbrie, and I think we should find out how that came about.
Well, actually, just shortly before, or a year before, we met in the Army quite by accident in a way. We were working together, and we were working in the same outfit in outside of Washington, and we met, I think, at a party, and since we were musicians, we struck up a lot of conversations and got very friendly, and as a matter of fact, we even did a musical together that was Stillborn, because while we were in production, the war ended, and all interest in it on our part and everyone else's sort of evaporated.
What was the gist of the musical?
I don't even know if it was an Army musical called Signals Mixed, and the score is still deathless and the lyrics live on in our minds. I think we have nothing on record for it. It was never performed, so we can't give the listeners a taste of Andrew Imbrie's show style, but I don't think he's written, actually, I think you've written things that have a light, immediate touch since, many things, as a matter of fact.
Well, I can grind out
Shaggy Dog
Broadway style tunes for clubs and army outfits and one thing or another, but these I keep within the family, so.
Yeah, I expect. Well, everybody had, Mozart had his party music, too, which whether he liked it or not, was sort of went on into perpetuity. But even aside from that, it does come out. And the Shaggy Dog, I don't think, ever received important public attention. That was a little chamber piece that had a wonderful lightness and highly syncopated quality. But I still hear, and I still insist, when one listens actively and feels that energies, the rhythmic energies in his music reflect that he has assimilated all kinds of music in his period. I think now the difference between you now and in 1946 is that whereas you realized much later that you had absorbed more of the Bartok second into that quartet than you then realized, I think now you probably are very conscious of well, I won't say influences, but of things that stimulate you from other music and other styles.
Yes, but I still feel that a style is more than the sum of its influences, and I think that if you're going to allow yourself to be influenced, it somehow has to, the thing that you are borrowing, if you're borrowing it, has to, you have to make contact with it. It isn't just an unabsorbed borrowing, and I feel, for instance, that here I'm going to cause a lot of disagreement with many people, I know, but for me, the music of Charles Ives is a good example of what I don't do with borrowed material. Charles Ives is enjoying a tremendous popularity at this point in history for all kinds of reasons which I don't particularly want to go into, but I find the music very disagreeable to listen to, simply because I feel that the influences are unabsorbed, that they are gathered together and placed in a kind of montage relationship to one another. Now, you can say, but it depends on how you place them, and the montage can express you just as anything else can. I feel it's that in some cases Ives succeeds in expressing Ives through montage techniques, and I think in many cases he does not succeed. What bothers me is that I don't have the confidence at any point to feel that he's going to succeed, and I think this is something that's important too. In my own music, I don't ever borrow anything that I can't handle, put it that way. And by handle, I mean make it part of what I consider to be my own music.
Well, in the development of these last 25 years since the first string quartet, you have absorbed a tremendous amount of what's been going on around you, and are you always aware of the input let's say, that comes into you. I know, for example, you're a devout Mahler enthusiast, yeah. and I know that you're very conscious of the sensitivity of Mahler to tone and sonority and many, many other features of it.
Oh yes,
but. So that in cases like this, when you're in tremendously involved with a Mahler composition and you're in the process of composition at the same time yourself, you're aware, really, of what ideas or possibilities are suggesting themselves to you.
Yes, I don't think that a given performance of somebody's composition, like a Mahler symphony, will make me run home and change what I've written or will suddenly give me an idea for what I am doing now. It isn't quite as direct a thing as that. I just think that what you said before is closer to the fact that you are constantly being, your ears are open to what goes on around you, both in music and in nature, and that all of these things provide the input which it's absolutely necessary for a composer to have. It's the machine that scrambles the input and produces the output that I'm interested in.
We had a big argument about that input a few months ago, and when I was... I had remarked that many composers isolate themselves from other wings of composition that are going on, other currents of composition that are going on, by reasons of philosophical difference with that wing or current of composition, or just for reasons of distaste for the kind of music that they're making. Mm. And so I accused certain branches or currents or individual composers of isolating themselves from the total musical activity on today. And your response, as I recalled, was that if you see through a thing or are not interested or inspired by it or don't find it particularly interesting, there's no point in committing yourself and committing your energies to...
Still, you should know enough about it before you make that decision. In other words, I don't think you should reject something without really giving it a try.
Well,
and it's just that there's a certain point. Now, you know, if you read one novel by such and such a novelist, and you read another one, you decide you don't like his style, I think you're perfectly justified in not reading the third one. I think the same thing is true in music, that you have to give it a chance. But now, for instance, the current avant-garde has many points of view, has many, articles of faith, you might say, that I disagree with. Just as the neoclassicists of my youth had articles of faith that I disagreed with. But in both cases, I feel the influence, and I feel that the avant-garde today has contributed tremendous amounts to our sense of sonority, particularly to our sense of color. And I would like very much to find a way to take advantage of the stimulus that this has given me. But I don't feel that I must accept their philosophy of music in order to do so, or that I must listen to their compositions assiduously and religiously in the hope of finding what I really want there, because I think I know what I have been able to find so far. Now, that I can always be proved wrong, and I'm willing at any point to hear a new composition if there's some chance that this new composition will reveal a new thing to me. I think that one must always keep one's ears open.
Well, getting to this article of faith thing, Roger Sessions, in his recent book, The Questions About Music, a book which I admired very much, he made the remark that oftentimes young composers who have made very flamboyant or extraordinary statements about the piece of music, and sometimes the piece of music succeeds in spite of and almost with no relationship to whatever they may have said about it.
In the same way that Stravinsky's music succeeds in being expressive.
Yes.
Although he says that he thinks that music should not express.
Yes. The whole idea of articles of faith, I think, is a problematical one, because one gets the statement about a piece as a substitute for the piece itself, or as an announcement.
Or you get the piece as a footnote to the statement. This is what is beginning to happen in some cases. The program note is the real work of art, and the piece of music is the illustration of it.
But getting for a moment in terms of your becoming interested in certain aspects of individual pieces, but not being able to or not wishing to incorporate it in yourself. Now, we've discussed electronic means and electronic music often, and you've expressed fascination with many things that Milton Babbitt has done and many things that others have done in electronic things, and have also expressed a kind of a wistful and often wistful urged that perhaps you might find something very valuable for yourself in it, yet that hasn't happened with you.
This may be just a practical problem. I have to learn the techniques in order to use them, and I have listened to a lot of electronic music written by people who have not learned these techniques very thoroughly, and the sounds to me are very dull and uninteresting. Unless they are created by someone who has really mastered these techniques, someone like Mario Davidovsky, for example, who I think is a virtuoso in the handling of these things. And I would like to have his kind of command over this material, and I feel that if I were ever to go into it, I would want to acquire that kind of mastery before I would ever consider letting anybody hear it. And this would mean giving up all my composition for the next 5 years.
Yeah,
and
5 years.
This is a purely practical problem. I would like to find the 5 years in which to do this, but I have no assurance in my own mind that 5 years will give me the kind of thing that I really want. Meanwhile, I have the urge to compose. I don't want to just go back to school at this stage. I want to write. And I think that this brings up another point, that any age which is going to be healthy for the artist has to allow artists time in which to develop themselves. When it becomes necessary to change every 3 or 4 years, and if you succumb, let's say, to the temptation of change at this rate, it becomes very difficult to develop, because I think styles mature like wines. They have to sit and mature over the years, and this is one thing that you learn. You can become... The other danger would be that you might become over refined and simply repeating your own methods, only refining them too far until it becomes a kind of a special little personal game. And I think that the corrective for that is to keep your ears open, as I said before. I think you're always on this dangerous tightrope between refining your own style and holding yourself open to influences from the outside. And each composer has to kind of decide just how far he can go in which direction, and try to keep his feet on the ground and try to keep in front of him what it is he's really trying to say, and the thing that he can say that nobody else can say better.
We're back with Andrew Imbrie and Robert Commande, and we're going to discuss some more of Mr. Imbrie's music. This is his 50th birthday tonight.
One aspect of music that we've discussed often is this problem of communication with the audience. And, of course, it was argued much in the press and among musicians because of people accusing composers of isolating themselves from their audiences and writing for themselves and it being a rather a private personal game. Now, I know this has never been your point of view, and that your whole emphasis has been to reach as immediately as possible. Now, sometimes this... For styles as complicated as yours, as complicated as Roger Sessions and others, it's necessary for listeners to have many hearings of a piece before this happens. We talked the other night about the composer needing this contact, needing if not a response, but needing a sense that he's speaking to people directly. Has this been your view throughout, or do you ever give up on this problem?
Oh, I can't give up on this problem, because when I'm writing a piece, even in my own room with my own piano with nobody else there, I'm writing for an audience, because I am the audience. I'm writing for myself. Now, this may sound as if I'm saying two opposite things at the same time, but it seems to me that the self-critical faculty is the opposite side of the creative coin. In order to create something, you have to criticize. This may seem very abstract, but I think it will be pertinent to what you are saying, or what you are asking me, rather. It seems to me that the self-critical faculty of the artist is the mode of thought in which he puts himself in the place of the listener. And he has to decide who that listener is in the process. When I write a piece, I ask myself, does it work or doesn't it work? Never mind how I arrived at it. Never mind whether I used numerology, whether I used the I Ching, or whether I derived it through symbolic logic or whatever. The question I ask myself is, does it work? And how do I answer that question? I answer that question by being an audience. And so I have to start with an initial act of faith. Namely, I have to believe that I have something in common with other people, and that what works for me has a chance of working for somebody else. If I can't depend on this, then I have failed. And I think many people do fail because they can't depend on this. I think many people think they can succeed by externalizing the whole problem and saying to themselves, I know what those guys are going to like. I know what Mrs. Jones is going to like, and therefore I will do it this way. And I don't think that you can ever say anything significant or even interesting in that manner. I think you have to say, what do I like? And then take take on faith the fact that if I like it, maybe somebody else will like it too.
In that line, or following on that, from the point of view of structuring works, I've often noted that when you approach a work or a movement of a work, it frequently has a governing idea, that is to say, not just a motive or a theme or a series of motives and themes that relate to each other, but rather some constructive principle or gestalt that handles on which the whole movement hinges. Mm-hmm. And your idea of a movement's working or of a piece's working sometimes, I think perhaps, as I understand it, relates to the idea that this construction, this constructive idea develops, unfolds, comes to its climax, if climax is the, if some kind of climax is the point of it, and then resolves. And I think every one of your pieces that you've discussed and that I've had contact with has had some kind of governing idea. We have the fourth quartet, which is going to be performed very soon by the Pro Arte Quartet here in Berkeley.
Not only on the 16th of April in Berkeley at Hertz Hall, but once again in San Francisco, I believe. Is that right?
I'm not sure where they're playing.
In San Francisco on the 19th at the Chamber Music Society concert at Fireman's Fund Auditorium.
Some of our listeners will be hearing that work, and you may have some words to say about, if I am correct in what I've said, what, in the largest sense of the word, inspired the piece.
Let me just modify one thing. It seems to me that you talk about a governing idea. I would almost rather talk of it, at least in terms of the compositional process, not as an idea with which I necessarily begin the composition, but you might call it the resultant idea. Of all the things I have done up to a certain point, I suddenly realize that things are tending in a certain direction. You might say you paint yourself into a corner, or you get yourself into a dangerous situation, and this is what sometimes stimulates you to finding an unusual solution for how to get out of that dangerous situation. And this might turn out to be the governing idea you're speaking of, which I wouldn't have discovered until I'd gotten myself into that dangerous situation. So with that proviso, I can say that in the case of the fourth quartet, in retrospect, I might look at it this way, that the first movement of the piece exploits a contrast between a fast and a slow section. This is something very, very traditional. But then, when the fast section returns, or we might put it this way, that the first and second sections, the fast and the slower, are contrasted in a rather traditional manner, that the first section is thoroughly liquidated, and then the second section is introduced in a rather formal way. When the return comes, the fast section becomes a kind of development, if you like, I suddenly discovered that I was doing something that I had never done before at that point, namely that the second section, the slow or the more reflective section, suddenly grows out of the first way in an unexpected manner, as if it were now consequent upon it rather than just subsequent to it. In other words, the whole formal thrust of the first movement is as if you were setting up a dichotomy and then showing that this dichotomy can be heard as all one thing, as if the dichotomy didn't really exist, as if the second term in the dichotomy was a kind of sublimation of the first term in the dichotomy, so that you've reached a kind of crisis, you've reached a kind of moment of highest tension, and all of a sudden the tension ceases to exist. It's as if you were suddenly, you had suddenly broken through some kind of barrier and were in another kind of experience, which was also a familiar experience. So that is the kind of thing that the first movement means to me now, and that's the way I felt about it while I was trying to solve the problem of how to bring the second part back in a fresh way. And all of a sudden I realized that this was a kind of an inevitable way to bring it back.
You say all of a sudden that you realized that...
While I was writing it, yes. I realized this was the solution. This is the way it had
to
be.
It was the solution. Do you think that there was while you were working on this, before you recognized it as the solution, that it was in your subconscious that the second movement had an effect, that the second slower section had an effect evolved in your subconscious out of the material in the first, and that it was your recognition of that fact that brought about the solution?
I don't know that it's so much a question of motivic similarity or a question of harmonic. It's a question of the relation between the two kinds of gesture,
uh-huh.
the two kinds of state. You might say mental state or emotional state or whatever you want to call
it.
It's much more generalized than the conventional sort of motivic relation business. Although that may be present, I'd have to go back and really look at it again to try to recapture what was going through my mind. You know, one thing about writing a piece is that when you finished it, it's the same thing that women tell me about having a baby, that they forget all the pain once the baby has arrived. And I think there's a little bit of this in composing. I don't think I can remember all the various labor pains that took place.
Do you ever have the experience that interpreters, having prepared your work for a performance or having performed one of your works, will come to you with observations about a piece of yours that you hadn't recognized or realized before, that coming at it from a different point of view, they all of a sudden... or that they suddenly bring to you a truth about it that, for example, a motivic relationship that you hadn't realized existed or some such.
Does
that often happen?
Yeah. I think you've done this for me a number of times when we were working together on the opera.
I think
you brought things to my attention which I hadn't quite thought of in the same way. Yes, this, I think, this is a very common occurrence. I think all these things are there if they may be subconscious. Again, I have been telling my students when we're looking at the music of other composers never to try to read the mind of the composer or try to say what he intended. All you can talk about is what is in the music. And strangely enough, I have to say that even about my own music, because I can't read my own mind. I can't even remember exactly how I arrived at certain things. And so I'm in the position of a completely different person, in a sense, when I look at some piece that I've written before. I can remember some things, like what I just described, but not all things.
In this performance, we hear the Pro Arti Quartet. Now, it's true that they've worked on all of your pieces for a string quartet. Is that right?
Yes. They commissioned the quartet, this quartet, under a program in which they would undertake to perform all the other works for quartet. But the best part of it for me was the fact that I had the opportunity to work very closely with them in preparing the first three quartets. And in the process of doing this, I got to know them personally and their style of playing so well that it helped me a great deal, gave me ideas for what to do in the fourth quartet. And then we worked that out, too, together. And this was a most rewarding experience. I received quite a good education in what to do about string writing from these people who are absolutely wonderful musicians.
I'd like to thank Andrew Imbrie, our guest tonight on this program, and also Robert Commande for taking time out from his very busy schedule to join us. Is there any final closing words? How about your next piece? What is it going to be?
Well, I'm going to write a trombone concerto for Stuart Dempster, who has asked me to do this, and that's my next project.
That sounds very exciting. You've done a lot of orchestral compositions, and unfortunately we don't have them here tonight, but there are three symphonies, I understand.
Yes, unfortunately it's not possible for us to broadcast the first two because they were simply taken off the air when performed by the San Francisco Symphony, and we have no authorization from the Musicians Union to broadcast them again.
Our guests tonight have been Robert Commande. Thank you very much, Bob.
Thank you.
And Andrew Imbrie. And happy birthday, Andrew.
Thank you.